For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sale.
I'm producer Robert Kirkwood, and coming up this week,
Miranda Emerson transports us to Soho in the swinging 60s for A Little London Scandal.
For Roald Dahl Day, I go through the Talking Books Library to discover there's much more than children's books.
Listener and founder of Baking Blind, Penny Melville Brown, reviews some thrillers she's been devouring.
Star of the US Office, BJ Novak, tells us about his book with no pictures.
And we return to Miranda Emerson for the books of her life.
All that coming up in today's show.
Miranda Emerson is a playwright and author living in Wales. Her debut novel, Miss Treadway and the Field of Stars, was published to great acclaim in 2017. Set in Soho during the swinging 60s, it captures the diversity and duality of London at a time when the establishment wielded power and the empire was crumbling. And now Miss Treadway is back in A Little London Scandal, set during 1967's Summer of Love. It's a story of class and corruption in Soho's theatre land. Miranda came onto the show to tell me more about it. Miranda, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I'm delighted that Miss Treadway is back. I thoroughly enjoyed the first novel, and I can't wait to get my hands on A Little London Scandal. It's just about to come into the library, so can you give us a taste?
Yes, of course. It's 1967. The first book was set in 65. We've moved on 20 months. And 67 is, in a way, in London, a slightly different world, in that we're sort of in the middle of the pop culture, everyone's idea of the 60s. So you have sort of a growing drug culture, but you have really exciting things happening with music. And there's a lot of demonstrations against the Vietnam War. So sort of the 60s, as people sort of think of them now in popular culture, are at their height. And what happens, it is summer, and one Saturday night, a very young male prostitute is killed close to Piccadilly Circus following a raid by the police. The police have raided where the young man meets other men, and he has run down a road, and his body is found the next morning in the garden of a gentleman's club, one of the very, very posh gentleman's clubs on Pall Mall. And at the same time, another young man, a young man who we're going to follow through the novel, called Nick Christou, who has also been working on the streets after being made homeless, he is having a very, very bad night on this very same night. And having finally extricated himself from his dreadful night, he is walking home past the scene of the crime, knowing nothing about it, when he is arrested by the police as a likely murderer. And he happens to be friends with Anna Treadway. They eat in the same cafe, owned by the lovely Otmar, the lovely Turkish owner of the cafe on Neal Street, where I set quite a lot of stuff. And Anna, having found out about this arrest, is so startled at the idea that lovely Nick, only 19, would hurt anyone, that she goes and speaks to her friend, the policeman, sort of friend, Barnaby Hayes, who himself has many, many doubts about the case. And off they set to try and prove that Nick could not have done it. And meanwhile, the one other key person to know about in this book is, so there was another small scandal in the first book involving a Labour politician and a young man who was also found hurt. And the Labour politician in this case, again, comes under suspicion, having been under suspicion once before. So the final important character in the book is his wife, Marion Wallace, who is trying to navigate a marriage with someone who she knows has affections in other directions, but who is trying to hold her family together and just wants to believe that her husband couldn't have hurt anyone, even if he hasn't entirely been faithful to her. So that is the beginning of the story.
And as anyone who has read your first novel will recognise, Soho's a real melting pot for both the highest echelons of society and the lowest misdemeanours. And it's a place where people come to build their dreams or hide from their pasts.
Yes, absolutely. The title of the first book was The Field of Stars, and it's an English version of a name of a Spanish town that's the end of a pilgrimage that many people do in Spain. And my feeling about London has always been, as someone who myself, part, half of my family, my mother's family, came here as immigrants at the time of the pogroms. And I've always felt very much that for a lot of people in London and other cities around the UK, the cities, they offer safety, they offer the prospect of work if you're living through a time when work is scarce. For some people who feel stuck in a very small place and understood, they offer possibilities to reinvent yourselves. And, you know, for someone like Nick Christie or some of the gay men in my book, they offer the possibility that there can be pubs where you can be yourself. There can be places where you can date other men. And that London is just this sort of wealth of possibility. Not that it's an easy city by any means, or not that anyone is guaranteed wealth or love or satisfaction, but it's what draws so many people there. And in the centre of London, you do have immense wealth and power cheek by jowl with people living through the most incredibly difficult things, you know, homelessness or drug addiction or whatever it might be. And because Piccadilly and Pall Mall and Soho and Covent Garden have all those really condensed communities of wealth and poverty and suffering, but also just really diverse communities, I just find them the most fascinating place to dive into and go, okay, let's tell lots of different stories of people having lots of different experiences, but what happens when their lives collide?
And Anna is right at the centre of that collision. She works as a dresser in the Galaxy Theatre, where dreams are made every night.
Yes. Well, I come from a theatre family. My parents are actors. And actually, the Galaxy is... after my family came to this country in the 1890s, initially they had no money and they were working in factories like a lot of immigrants do. They absolutely had to start at the bottom. But my great-grandfather, Victor Luxemburg, by the time he was in middle age, he had built up enough money that he was investing in and helping to build actually review bars in Soho, to my great-grandmother's absolute horror. She was very embarrassed about this. But also theatres. He built the Phoenix Theatre on the Charing Cross Road with Sidney Bernstein. And so I decided, since it's this little piece of family history, that I would turn it into the Galaxy and I would put my main character, whose beginnings, whose background has a little bit in common with my own family's background, I would put her in there because I love theatre. Sometimes I can be a bit cynical about theatre as well because I grew up in it and I knew hundreds of actors and I know it's difficult being an actor and theatre can be silly and ridiculous and difficult and lots of other things, but there is something rather magical about it. And for the audiences who come, theatre in London is extraordinary. And I think even for those who work in London for years, like when my parents, my dad's been acting for 60 years, even after you know all the dreadful things about it, there is something magical about the ritual of those spaces and everyone gathering to see these plays. There is something slightly extraordinary about it.
And your theatre background really comes through in your novel writing, because you create a fantastic ensemble cast. Yes, the story is about Anna Treadway, but it's her friends and acquaintances mm-hmm. who surround her that make the rich world of the novel.
Thank you. I think that's true. And it's really nice to hear that as well. I think that a little bit this comes from the fact that I originally trained as a playwright and I wrote for radio. I wrote for Radio 4 for a long time. And obviously, as a playwright, almost always you're thinking about a group of characters. You're thinking about a group of voices and what happens when you get them together. Whereas I think sometimes if you go straight into novel writing, sometimes the inclination can be to have that single mind and to investigate a single experience of life, which can be absolutely fascinating. It's just a different way to do it. But I wanted to write about an ensemble, but I think also in terms of my politics, not in party political terms, but politics in a broader sense, which is that I'm fascinated by community and I'm really interested in what makes a community and how different we all are. But those points of connection, I find immense hope in my own life and in literature in the fact that you can explore communities that are very diverse, but they can find those meeting points, those points of kindness, those points of reaching out to another person, or even the love stories within them that sort of give us hope and remind us that we are just all human.
which is something that we've come very much face to face with this year during the pandemic.
Yes. In fact, I've said I've got two quite young children, and I've said a lot to the children, do you know what, kids? This isn't like anything else, but we are living through something that we are sharing with most of the rest of the world. And there is a combined humanity in the fact that we are all experiencing this. We're all scared. We're all anxious. But the way through it is that we can reach out to each other and go, I know, and it's really difficult, and have a lot of virtual hugs. And that reaching out, actually, we might come out with a stronger sense of community, because it would be beautiful if that could happen. I think as a country, particularly at the moment, we need to refind our sense of community and shared humanity. And I think the pandemic has reminded people of that, even if people are feeling still a bit scared right now.
Absolutely. Now, your books have been beautifully brought to life by two fantastic narrators. In the case of Miss Treadway and The Field of Stars, it was Adjoa Ando, who's been a guest on Read On herself. And the latest novel has been read by Karen Cass. Were you tempted to ask for more than one narrator, since it's an ensemble cast, or were you very definite that the books should only have a single narrator?
Wow, that's a really interesting question. I think that I had probably assumed, even though I come out of radio, where the natural thing would be to have maybe multiple voices, I think I had assumed that I would probably get a single narrator. And the style in which the books are written, so they're written in something called close third. So they're written in a third person, but the narrator that I put in the story isn't omniscient. He or she does not know everything that's happening. So if we spend a section in one person's consciousness, so we might be in Anna's for a bit, and then we're in Nick's for a bit. So we have these multiple views. I do actually love recordings with multiple voices. I remember one of the most exciting audiobooks I heard last year was Lincoln in the Bardo, which they did with an extraordinary number of voices. I mean, obviously, it is written for many voices. But I love what the actresses have done with the text, and I love what they've done bringing it to life. But it is true, as a radio soul at heart, I think joint casts are a very exciting way to listen to things and to record audio.
From the audience, and Anna had sat in enough audiences to know this, the players, beautifully dressed, shining white under the lights, seemed almost godlike. An audience member could no more imagine speaking to these creatures than they could imagine running up onto the stage and touching them as they moved. But in the wings they looked small, their steps tentative. Anna could see the way their fingers played silently on tables and chair backs when they weren't speaking. She heard the pauses in the pattern of the scene that had not been there the day before, because someone was stumbling on their lines or the person before them hadn't reached their spot.
Maybe the new boy will freshen it up,
Bertie said, as he unbuttoned his waistcoat and jacket in the semi-darkness of the wings. Anna gathered the pieces of clothing from him as he shed them one by one. The wings had an intimacy to them, but it was not romantic in nature. The intimacy was born of shared secrets, of seeing what the audience could not, knowing how the machinery worked, or knowing that there was a machine at all.
I don't think the actors are the problem, Anna whispered back. The circle are half asleep. You can see the tops of their heads.
She caught Bertie's sharp expression.
Don't tell me that, he said.
It's the heat, Anna whispered. They'll perk up when autumn hits.
Autumn is a long way off.
The evening, Anna tried. The evening will be better.
Bertie shot her a dry smile.
That's what we all tell ourselves, isn't it?
Karen Cass narrating A Little London Scandal, written by my guest, Miranda Emerson. So, Miranda, you're obviously delighted that both books have been made into audiobooks, and I believe that you've got special reason to be so.
Yes, because I adore audiobooks, and sight loss and various things have affected my family through the generations. My grandmother had cataracts very badly, had been a voracious reader. And it was at a time when audiobooks, so this is the 80s, were less available. You got a little bit on tape, but I know it was very hard for her not to have a range of books that she would have wanted to read in the last 10 years of her life. But then coming sort of down the generations, three members of my parents' generation, including my husband's family, are all suffering from macular degeneration. Now, they're all being treated for it, and the treatment is great, and it's helped stabilize it. But they've had to make changes in how they read in terms of lighting and what kind of books they choose, you know, in terms of type and accessibility. And we've had those conversations about where it is progressing, the audiobooks are the next step. And I'm so happy for them that almost every, certainly all the literary titles that they would want to read are now released on audiobook, and that they have this wealth of literature that they won't be shut off from. I will just add, although it's not about sight loss, that in my own case, the reason why audiobooks mean so much to me is that I'm dyslexic. And my dyslexia is relatively mild in terms of my ability to read. However, as I got older, I had children. What I found was, because I read a lot during the day as a writer, by the evening, my brain just couldn't process. It couldn't do the sort of concentration that it needed to allow me to read for pleasure. And for a few years, I sort of lost reading for pleasure. And then very fortunately, this was at a time when both the production of audiobooks and podcasts and things like that, there was an enormous amount of audio content suddenly became available. And I rediscovered reading for pleasure, but now I do it through audiobooks. And as someone with dyslexia, I am so grateful that audiobooks exist, because I really think, actually, if you count up all of the people who are affected by all the different reasons you might be to struggle to read on the page, there's actually quite a lot of this nation that needs an alternative and is really well served by audiobooks.
Well, we will come back at the end of the show to hear the books of your life. But just to wrap up this part of the interview, are you already working on a third Miss Treadway novel?
I did actually at the beginning of lockdown, my anxiety and adrenaline sort of went into hyperdrive, and I sat down and I wrote half a novel in about 6 weeks. And it was half of a third Treadway, which I'm very happy with. Except after 6 weeks of doing this and attempting to homeschool my young children, I sort of burnt out and have spent the rest of lockdown going, I'm just going to swim in the sea now with my children. I can't cope with anything else. But yes, there is a third Treadway that has not yet been bought, but does exist, which is in part set at the Edinburgh Festival in late 67. And I had such fun writing that. I cannot tell you, it was wonderful. So yes, it sort of exists.
Well, I shall thoroughly look forward to that and hope that you'll come back onto the show to talk about it. But in the meantime, I've got a little London scandal to get to grips with. And so, Miranda Emerson, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On and telling us a little bit more about Miss Treadway and your own life as a writer.
Thank you so much.
Both Miss Treadway and The Field of Stars and A Little London Scandal are available from the RNIB Talking Books Library. And as I said, Miranda will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. Now, Roald Dahl Day is on the 13th of September, and it's not just his children's books in the RNIB Library. Here's Robert with more.
Here is James Henry Trotter when he was about 4 years old. And there's a picture of a very happy little boy. Up until this time, he had had a happy life, living peacefully with his mother and father in a beautiful house beside the sea. There were always plenty of other children for him to play with, and there was the sandy beach for him to run about on, and the ocean to paddle in. It was the perfect life for a small boy.
The voice of Roald Dahl, when he visited the RNIB Talking Book Studios to record James and the Giant Peach.
Then one day, James's mother and father went to London to do some shopping. And there, a terrible thing happened. Both of them suddenly got eaten up, in full daylight, mind you, and on the crowded street, by an enormous angry rhinoceros which had escaped from the London Zoo.
Roald Dahl was born on the 13th of September 1916 in South Wales. When he was 13, he was sent to Repton Public School, which he described as very harsh. The headmaster enjoyed beating children, and the older students used the younger ones as servants. However, there was one good thing about the school. Every few months, the chocolate company Cadbury's sent boxes of chocolates to the school for the students to test. This happy memory gave Dahl the idea for one of his most famous novels, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Mr. Willy Wonka can make marshmallows that taste of violets, and rich caramels that change colour every 10 seconds as you suck them, and little feathery sweets that melt away deliciously the moment you put them between your lips. He can make chewing gum that never loses its taste, and sugar balloons that you can blow up to enormous sizes before you pop them with a pin and gobble them up. And, by a most secret method, he can make lovely bluebird's eggs with black spots on them. And when you put one of these in your mouth, it gradually gets smaller and smaller until suddenly there's nothing left except a tiny little pink sugary baby bird sitting on the tip of your tongue.
David Thorpe reading from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory by Roald Dahl. And David also narrates the sequel, Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator. After school, Dahl decided he wanted to travel. He got a job with the Shell Oil Company and 2 years later was sent to East Africa. In his autobiography, Going Solo, he recounts some of the exciting adventures there.
With a movement so fast it was invisible, the snake's head came up about 2 feet off the floor and the front of the body arched backwards, ready to strike. Almost simultaneously, it bunched its whole body into a series of curves, ready to flash forward. The snake man was just a bit too far away from the snake to reach it with the end of his pole. He waited, staring at the snake, and the snake stared back at him with 2 small malevolent black eyes. Then the snake man started speaking to the snake. "Come along, my pretty," he whispered in a soft, wheedling voice. "There's a good boy. Nobody's going to hurt you. Nobody's going to harm you, my pretty little thing. Just lie still and relax."
Robin Brown reading from Going Solo, part 2 of Roald Dahl's autobiography. The second part creates a world as bizarre and unnerving as anyone will find in fiction. An evocation of his wartime exploits, tales of African safaris and deadly snakes, of fighter planes and air battles with the enemy during World War II.
After I'd gone solo, I was allowed to go up alone for much of the time, and it was wonderful. How many young men, I kept asking myself, were lucky enough to be allowed to go whizzing and soaring through the sky above a country as beautiful as Kenya? Even the aeroplane and the petrol were free. In the great Rift Valley, the big game and small game were as plentiful as cows on a dairy farm, and I flew low in my little tiger moth to look at them. Oh, the animals I saw every day from that cockpit! I would fly for long periods at a height of no more than 60 or 70 feet, gazing down at huge herds of buffalo and wildebeest, which would stampede in all directions as I whizzed over. From an illustrated book I'd bought in Nairobi, I learnt to recognise kudu, Thompson's gazelle, eland, impala, and many other animals. I saw plenty of giraffe and rhino and elephant and lion, and once I spotted a leopard, sleek as silk, lying along the trunk of a large tree. He was watching some impala grazing below him and deciding which one to have for his dinner.
Going Solo is read by Robin Brown. And the first part of his autobiography, Boy, Tales of Childhood, is narrated by Ian Craig. Although the author insists that it isn't an autobiography, but it does give some very interesting glimpses into the early years of Roald Dahl. Before writing the books, which arguably made him the most famous, he was known as one of the masters of the macabre, taking ordinary characters and plunging them into dreadful fantasy from which there is no escape.
There is a reason for all things, and in this case the reason was obvious. The cook's scalp was infested with purulent, seborrheic impetigo. And the hair itself, the long black hair that I might so easily have swallowed had I been less alert, was therefore swarming with millions and millions of living pathogenetic cocci, whose exact scientific name I have happily forgotten.
Christopher Scott, reading from the best of Roald Dahl, 20 spine-chilling stories. He is, of course, best known for his children's stories, which he started writing in 1961. And in an exclusive introduction to the RNIB version of James and the Giant Peach, he explained why.
James and the Giant Peach was the very first of the 15 or 16 children's books I have written. I wrote it in 1961 in America, some 26 years ago. And up to then, I'd spent a long time, about 15 years, writing only short stories for adults. But by then, I had a couple of children of my own, and I used to tell them stories in bed, and one day I told them one that they seemed to like and wanted more of, and it was about a peach. And so I thought, well, why don't I try to write a children's book about it? And so I did.
Roald Dahl's reading of James and the Giant Peach is available in audio from RNIB Talking Books, as is Easy O'Trot, The Giraffe and the Pelly and Me, Dirty Beast, The Idiots, The Magic Finger, Danny the Champion of the World, The Twits, The Witches, Fantastic Mr. Fox, Matilda, The BFG, The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar and six more, and many more, including biographies by Donald Sturrock and by Chris Powling. It's all available from RNIB Talking Books. Head to www.rnib.org.uk for more information.
Penny Melville Brown is a retired naval commander and the founder of Disability Dynamics and Baking Blind, both of which seek to highlight the capabilities of blind and other disabled people. She's also an avid reader with a serious audiobook habit, and has kindly agreed to record a series of book reviews for the show. So, over to you, Penny.
One of the books I'd really like to suggest to other people is the whole series by Stephen Booth. And I've just been reading Dead in the Dark. And this is all about a young man called Ben. And he is now a detective inspector. And throughout the series, he's sort of graduated from constable up through sergeant up to now this august role of his inspector. And he does all the murder investigations in this part of Derbyshire. And that's quite interesting, and they're nice stories. But what is so special about these books is the wonderful sense they give of Derbyshire, the Peak District, the Dark Peak, and all the other areas. This is a man who has a real sense of the vegetation, the landscape, the animals, the wildlife, both underground and overground, because in this book they're into the caves under the Peak District. And they are just a super series of books, and I really recommend them to anyone.
No one wants to die in the dark, to lie alone in the blackness, feeling the chill of death creep slowly over you. Shut away from the light as the fear numbs your limbs and chokes the breath in your throat. The long, long sinking into the cold depths. And then to sense that slipping away, the final slipping away into nothing. Do you feel that stab of pain as it shoots through your chest? Try to make your breathing more shallow. You have several broken ribs, a fractured arm, perhaps a punctured lung. You can hardly know in the dark.
Mike Rogers narrating Dead in the Dark by Stephen Booth, which is available commercially.
And Red, you know that I'm a great fan of detective books, and particularly ones that are set overseas. And the next one, and it's another series, is Martin Walker's Children of War. And this is all about Bruno, Chief of Police, who is the municipal police officer in charge of a little town called Saint-Denis. I probably got awful French pronunciation. And it's all very idyllic, lovely landscapes. And for me, with all my baking blind stuff, he also throws in the odd recipe, which he cooks. And again, it's a lovely sense of the place where all this is happening. The stories are good, but the places are even better.
And for me, it really reminds me of the last 3 years where I've been living in France month a month about, not in quite the same area, but in the Anjou area of France. And it takes you back to these very small towns with close communities where everybody knows each other and where all sorts of mysteries and things can happen, but against that setting of wonderful landscape and great food.
The ground is dry beneath his hips, said Bruno. The storm broke just after 2 this morning, so presumably they chained him to the tree before then.
You were awake for the storm? She asked.
He nodded. The lightning had not disturbed him, but the quick scuttle of Balzac into his bed had jolted him awake just as the thunder came. Usually barred from his master's bed, the basset hound was still young enough to be granted a dispensation during the tempests that occasionally gave this gentle valley of the river Vézère a brief taste of an Indian monsoon. Bruno had risen, gone to the window, and looked out to see if the rain was hard enough to damage the vineyards now that the harvest was due.
Peter Noble, narrating Children of War by Stephen Walker, which is published as Death Undercover in the UK and is available commercially.
The next one I want to recommend, and I've just been rereading, people may remember The Darling Buds of May, and I've been rereading H.E. Bates' A Breath of French Air, which is all about Pop and Ma Larkin going over to France with all the family, all stuffed into their huge Rolls Royce, which of course he got for a song, and having an amazing time in France. And there's lots of sort of sex and booze, and that all turns into lots of innocent passion and rather a clash of cultures and language. But underneath it all is lots of people learning about each other, enjoying each other, and those little sparks of sex that follow it through.
Little Oscar, Ma Larkin's seventh, to whom she hoped in due course to give a real proper ribbon of names, probably calling him after some famous explorer, admiral, or Roman emperor, or even the whole lot, lay in his lavish silvery pram in the kitchen, looking remarkably like a very soft, very large apple dumpling that's been slightly overboiled. Continual small bubbles of spittle oozed softly like pink juice from his lips. And Pop, coming in to breakfast after giving morning swill to the pigs, paused affectionately to wipe them off with a feeder worked all over in royal blue daisies and a bright scarlet picture of Miss Muffet, the big spider, and the curds and whey. Ma, who looked, if anything, 6 inches wider since having the baby than she'd done even while carrying it, had worked the feeder herself. She hadn't all that much time to spare with 7 on her hands, but she was surprisingly clever with her plump olive fingers that were almost hidden in pearl and turquoise rings. "Soon be as fat as a Christmas gander," Pop said, at the same time pausing to give his son-in-law, Mr. Charlton, his customary open-handed clout of greeting in the middle of the back.
Raymond Adamson, narrating A Breath of French Air by H.E. Bates, which is available from the RNIB Talking Books Library. Penny, thank you very much for a wonderful series of mini breaks into the country and abroad.
Absolutely. Happy summer reading.
Would you like to share the books that you've been enjoying with the listeners? Why not drop us a line? The address is radio@rnib.org.uk.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. Now, during lockdown, one of the many TV shows I've been binging is the American version of The Office. One of the producers, writers and stars of the show, BJ Novak, visited the RNIB Talking Book Studios to talk about the Braille version of his children's book, The Book with No Pictures.
This is a book with no pictures. It might seem like no fun to have someone read you a book with no pictures. It probably seems boring and serious, except here is how books work. Everything the words say the person reading the book has to say. No matter what. That's the deal. That's the rule. So that means, even if the words say,
Blork.
Wait, what? That doesn't even mean anything.
Blurf.
Wait a second. What? This isn't the kind of book I wanted to read. And I have to say every word the book says? Uh-oh.
That's BJ Novak reading from his book, The Book with No Pictures. The print version is published by Puffin, and Puffin announced a partnership with RNIB to produce Braille and giant print versions of the book, the most talked about non-picture book in years, and it's been number one on the New York Times bestseller list for 6 months. BJ visited the Talking Book Studios and first of all told us about the book.
The Book with No Pictures is, I would say, sort of a script for a comedy performance. It is a book that explains that it may seem boring to you to hear about a book with no pictures, but in fact, it could be very interesting because every word a book says, the person reading the book has to say, even if the words say. And from there, there are a lot of very silly sentences, unusual sounds, words, nonsense, and it really makes the person reading the book have to be very foolish in a way that can be very enjoyable.
And is it possible to do a bad performance of the book?
I have not seen anyone fail to do a good performance. The fun of the book is that the person reading it is the one doing all these silly things. So often that's, if you're a kid, that's your parent, that's your teacher, that's your uncle, that's your grandfather. So the fact that this person, who is normally rather serious and in control, now is saying all these silly things, that's the funny part. It actually doesn't need a funny voice. Just the fact that this is someone that you know being silly is the funny part.
You've written an adult book, One More Thing, Stories and Other Stories. Why was your second book a children's book?
Well, I always gravitate towards children. I always want to be talking to them. And if there are books around, I often ask if I can read them a book because I'm a writer. I love books. I love kids. Perfect combination. So I ask, what's your favorite book? And I read it. And often there are some funny ones like Dr. Seuss or Mo Willems is a very funny author. But sometimes I would be reading a book and wishing it were funnier or starting to imagine what I imagine that the child wishes the book were more like. And that's what gave me the idea to write my own book that could be sort of a child's dream come true in terms of what a silly, unexpected reading experience could be.
Was there a lot of trial and error in getting the phrasing and the language just right?
Most of the language came the first time, more or less. I really had an improvisational energy with a lot of the silly sounds and nonsense sentences. I did change some of the spellings of the words simply to make it easier for parents to read. I didn't want too many bizarre-looking syllables because, again, some parents were intimidated when they heard that this book was very funny. Some parents thought, oh, well, I'm not funny. I can't read it. So I didn't want anyone to have that misconception and look at the book and have it look intimidating. So I made everything simple to read so that parents wouldn't have that fear.
The publishers Puffin have partnered with RNIB to make the giant print and braille versions of the book. Now, in the print book, the font size and the colour is quite important to the flow of the book. Do you think that's going to change when someone reads it in braille?
I don't know what the design of the book is in braille, if any letters have larger sizes than others to emphasize or are underlined. But I would imagine there are ways to convey that. But if not, it's also, I think, going to be read perfectly well. The real reason that I had different sizes and colors of different words was simply to show the reader that they had freedom to be loud, be expressive, to mutter something under their breath if the words were small. But I think that can come pretty intuitively to any reader. It's not actually visually important to the book to see that. It's simply a little way to nudge the reader along so that they can perform in bigger or smaller voices without thinking about it too much.
Do you need a degree of comic timing to read the book?
I think the funnier you are, the funnier the book is, and the better timing you have, the better it is. But it's not really very dependent on that, this book. It's really, again, the fact of an authority figure saying, I'm a monkey who taught myself to read. Hey, I'm not a monkey. That is the funny part. And I think that inspires a pretty natural timing that is natural to that parent or adult for most of the book. So I think if you have great timing, great. But I don't think that it's really required or going to be unusual to find someone who has the right timing. I think the right timing is simply to say it naturally. I am a monkey who taught myself to read. Hey, I'm not a monkey. And now I am reading you this book with my monkey mouth in my monkey voice. That's not true. I'm not a monkey.
How important were children's books, or any books for that matter, to you when you were growing up?
I loved books growing up, and it was very important to me. And I think one of the lessons that I took from books that I hope that this book can inspire in children is that books are on your side. Books are your friends, and this is where you go when you feel angry or mischievous or silly or excited. And it was very important to me with this book to give children a book that was on their side and showed them that books are not the area of their teachers or their parents. They're not a boring thing that are supposed to be used for homework. Books are where you go when you're not doing your homework. That was very important to me. And I think that as you get older, when you get more rebellious and mischievous, you realize that books are so powerful, they can really lead to anything. And I think it's great for a child to know that at an early age, that when you're sick of your parents, you should read a book about bad parents. And when you're sick of your friends, you should read a book about evil friends. And when you're sick of being serious, you should read a book that is absolutely ridiculous. So for me, reading was always a place that I knew was for me. And I definitely want to pass that on to children.
And how important is it to you that Puffin and RNIB have made these accessible versions of the book?
I'm very happy that everyone will be able to experience this book. It is, again, something that for me is very inspiring to think of, a sense of humor that children can feel they have the control over. And this book is very much about unlocking the power of the written word. It's being translated into over 20 languages, and I love that children in all these different countries and have all these different reading experiences will be able to take out the humor and power of the written word, which is really what this book is all about. No pictures, no tricks, just the fact that words can take you anywhere. So I'm glad that all types of children can get to experience that.
And how was it, alongside actor Busy Phillips, narrating the audiobook version?
I think it actually comes more naturally to me because I'm really about the words. That's why I wrote the book with no pictures. I really do like isolating the words and making them stand on their own. So for me, it was great to not have to worry about my body or my physical appearance and really just focus on the words themselves. I narrated my own audiobook, my book of short stories, One More Thing, and I got a lot of other actors, especially female actors, to read the female voices. Emma Thompson, your compatriot, is on the book, as is Carey Mulligan, and some wonderful actors from America as well. So that was very fun for me to narrate and produce that book.
You are a producer along with being an actor, a stand-up comedian, a screenwriter, an author, and a director as well. What do you think gives you the most creative freedom? What do you like best?
Well, my favorite thing to do is a way to unite them all, which is really performing my own writing. That's really the most satisfying moment to me. I consider myself a writer, but my greatest pleasure as a writer is to see my work being realized. So I don't like to let go of my work. In fact, my book of stories, a friend recommended that I publish it with the title, I Wish I Could Watch You Read This, because he noticed that I liked to not only hand him the book, but watch his face as he read what I wrote. I love seeing that final experience happen. So for me, writing the book and then reading it out loud, I've been going to a lot of schools with the book with no pictures and reading it to large groups of children. And to me, that's my truest pride, is taking something I've written and watching the reaction as I perform it. Yes, I am a monkey. Also, I am a robot monkey. What? And my head is made of blueberry pizza. Wait a second. And that's the beginning of the book with no pictures.
Thanks once again to BJ Novak and to Puffin and to RNIB.
Now it's back to Miranda Emerson for the books of her life. So, Miranda, was there a book that you read that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
The children's novel that absolutely woke me up to the possibilities of the world you could talk about was The Magician's Nephew by C.S. Lewis. And I'd read The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, and The Magician's Nephew is actually the prequel to that. And he wrote it later, after the Second World War. And it's an extraordinary book because there's a sort of realist bit where there's a little boy whose mum is very ill and he's very scared, which is written so beautifully and so movingly. And then C.S. Lewis creates this extraordinary dystopian world that the children end up jumping into, this kind of awful world where everything's gone wrong and everything's been war and people terrible to each other. And then he jumps us into the beginning of Narnia. And between all of those, he creates this thing called The Wood Between the Worlds. And The Wood Between the Worlds is so influential to me as a writer that I put it in most of my novels. In fact, you will find a reference to The Wood Between the Worlds in A Little London Scandal. And The Wood Between the Worlds is this extraordinary place that is very calm and peaceful. And it's like a garden. And in it, there are many pools. And if you jump into the pool, you jump into an alternate reality in a way. There are different worlds and different ways the world could work. And I found that this utterly opened up my imagination. And I was so thrilled at the idea of exploring different worlds as a writer that sort of set me off.
In those days, Mr. Sherlock Holmes was still living in Baker Street, and the Bastables were looking for treasure in the Lewisham Road. In those days, if you were a boy, you had to wear a stiff Eton collar every day, and schools were usually nastier than now. But meals were nicer. And as for sweets, I won't tell you how cheap and good they were, because it would only make your mouth water in vain. And in those days, there lived in London a girl called Polly Plummer. She lived in one of a long row of houses which were all joined together. One morning, she was out in the back garden when a boy scrambled up from the garden next door and put his face over the wall. Polly was very surprised, because up till now there had never been any children in that house, but only Mr. Kettley and Miss Kettley, a brother and sister, old bachelor and old maid, living together. So she looked up, full of curiosity. The face of the strange boy was very grubby. It could hardly have been grubbier if he had first rubbed his hands in the earth and then had a good cry and then dried his face with his hands. As a matter of fact, this was very nearly what he had been doing. "Hello," said Polly. "Hello," said the boy. "What's your name?" "Polly," said Polly. "What's yours?" "Diggory," said the boy. "I say, what a funny name," said Polly. "It isn't half so funny as Polly," said Diggory. "Yes, it is," said Polly. "No, it isn't," said Diggory. "At any rate, I do wash my face," said Polly, "which is what you need to do, especially after..." And then she stopped. She had been going to say, "after you've been blubbing," but she thought that wouldn't be polite.
Kenneth Branagh narrating The Magician's Nephew by C.S. Lewis, which is available from the RNIB Talking Books Library. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I think it would probably be Great Expectations. I'm going for some real classics here. It would probably be Great Expectations by Dickens. Dickens was somebody who I also loved as a slightly older child. And Dickens is someone who's influenced me a lot as a writer because he was such a humanist. He cared so much about people. He so much said to come into this life so unlike your own, but let's see why this person is like that. Let's see what happened to them. He's so kind and he has so much heart, but he's funny as well. And he'll whisk you through London and you'll meet all these different people and you'll see the ways in which they interact. But I just feel that he asks you to open your mind and open your heart. And Great Expectations is probably maybe the earliest classic I read, and I completely identified with Pip, and that's never really left me. I just think it's a beautiful book.
My father's family name being Pirrip, and my Christian name Philip, My infant tongue could make of both names nothing longer or more explicit than Pip. So I called myself Pip, and came to be called Pip. I give Pidip as my father's family name, on the authority of his tombstone, and my sister Mrs. Joe Gargery, who married the blacksmith. As I never saw my father or my mother, and never saw any likeness of either of them, for their days were long before the days of photographs, my first fancies regarding what they were like were unreasonably derived from their tombstones. The shape of the letters on my father's gave me an odd idea that he was a square, stout, dark man, with curly black hair. From the character and turn of the inscription, "Also Georgiana, wife of the above," I drew a childish conclusion that my mother was freckled and sickly. To five little stone lozenges, each about a foot and a half long, which were arranged in a neat row beside their grave, and were sacred to the memory of five little brothers of mine, who gave up trying to get a living exceedingly early in that universal struggle, I am indebted for a belief I religiously entertained, that they had all been born on their backs with their hands in their trousers pockets, and had never taken them out in this state of existence. Ours was the marsh country down by the river, within, as the river wound, 20 miles of the sea. My first, most vivid and broad impression of the identity of things seems to me to have been gained on a memorable raw afternoon towards evening. At such a time I found out for certain that this bleak place, overgrown with nettles, was the churchyard, and that Philip Pidip, late of this parish, and also Georgiana, wife of the above, were dead and buried, and that Alexander, Bartholomew, Abraham, Tobias, and Roger, infant children of the aforesaid, were also dead and buried, and that the dark, flat wilderness beyond the churchyard, intersected with dikes and mounds and gates, with scattered cattle feeding on it, was the marshes, and that the low, leaden line beyond was the river, and that the distant, savage lair from which the wind was rushing was the sea, and that the small bundle of shivers, growing afraid of it all and beginning to cry, was Pip.
Andrew Timothy, narrating Great Expectations by Charles Dickens, which is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yes, the book that has been most vivid in my mind this year has been Such a Fun Age by Kylie Reid. She's an American author, and it's a very funny, very brilliant book, somewhat satiric, and it starts when a young black babysitter is called out of a party one night by her white employers, and they ask her to take the toddler out of their house, and there's nowhere for her to take this toddler late at night, so she goes to a grocery store. And in it, the security guard gives her a hard time because she's a young black woman in a party dress with a young white child. And of course, these times being what they are, someone decides to film this. They film this encounter and say, oh, well, I'll put it online. And then Such a Fun Age tells the story very brilliantly of the young babysitter and her employer and the man who takes the video. And it's funny and it's moving and it's brilliantly about all the stuff that we're living through right now. But she tells it in such an engaging story that you're whisked along in it and you care so much about the characters. So I highly recommend it. It's a very good audiobook. I listened to it and it was fab.
Alix met Peter in a bar at age 25. And if she were honest about it, she'd admit that she thought he was much taller until he stood up at the end of their conversation. But in addition to her height, he matched her personality. Peter did all these enchanting things that were fancy but not showy, like put mint in his water and privately tip 30%. What Alix immediately liked best about Peter was that he treated her side project like an actual job. Alix had a self-deprecating way of describing her letters. Well, I write letters and reviews, and I have this blog, but it's tiny. It's not a big thing at all. Peter told her to try that again, but this time to pretend like it was. Peter was a journalist turned newscaster who was raised in upstate New York. He was 8 years older than Alix.
He didn't think it was strange to wear makeup on camera, and he firmly believed in building your brand. When Alix married Peter at age 28, the party favors, her shoes, and the white wine at her wedding were all items she'd received free of charge from handwriting gorgeous letters and promising glowing reviews. On a honeymoon in Santorini, Peter helped her write each rave. Alix worked in student recruitment at Hunter College when a friend, a high school English teacher at Columbia Grammar and Prep, asked her to give a cover letter writing workshop to one of her classes. One of the attending students was 17-year-old Lucy, a senior with unrealistically white teeth, light pink hair, and an Instagram following of 36,000. 3 months after the workshop, Lucy posted a picture to her account featuring the cover letter and essay she drafted with Alix on top of acceptance letters from UC Irvine, UC Santa Barbara, Fordham, and Emerson. "I owe all of my acceptances to Alix," she said in her caption. "Honestly, never would have applied to half these schools if she hadn't made my application so bomb. Hashtag, all you have to do is ask. Hashtag, write a letter. Hashtag, let her." Lucy's post received more than 1,700 likes, and seemingly overnight, Alix Chamberlain became a brand.
Nicole Lewis narrating Such a Fun Age by Kylie Reed, which is available commercially. Well, Miranda Emerson, thank you so much for sharing your obvious passion for reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Red. It's been really delightful doing this. I've really enjoyed it.
If you want to share the books of your life or ask us about anything that you've heard on Read On, the email address is radio@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. But don't forget to tune in at the same time next week, or you can always download the show as a podcast.
Just search for RNIB Audiobook Show Read On in your favourite podcast app. We're available on Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and wherever you found this.
And if you can, why not rate, review, and leave us 5 stars?
Please do. Hitting like really helps us get the word out about Read On, the audiobook show.
You can find us on Twitter. I'm at RedSale, which is RedSzell.
And I'm at Talking_Books.
Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.